Banks are struggling to reinvent their local branches and keep them relevant.
Capital One, and this is in their branches too, their people kind of have more relaxed attire. There's let's open your account and an iPad. It's just kind of more of this chill. I feel like you could almost call it, just from thinking about what the trades are, a startup-y vibe a little bit.
Washington gears up for the first public hearings in the impeachment inquiry and the hazards of being real on social media. It's Tuesday, November 12th. This is the AM edition of What's News from the Wall Street Journal. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli in New York. Behind closed doors, Pentagon official Laura Cooper told impeachment investigators that nearly $400 million in aid to Ukraine was put on hold due to the president's concerns about corruption in the country. A transcript of Cooper's testimony, released Monday, describes confusion and concern at the Pentagon about the hold on security aid over the summer. Cooper, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia, said officials questioned whether the Office of Management and Budget had the legal authority to hold the money. The House committees also released transcripts of testimony by two Ukraine experts at the State Department, Catherine Croft and Christopher Anderson. The transcripts revealed there were concerns over the administration's handling of foreign policy with respect to Ukraine. The committees have been releasing transcripts from officials who testified behind closed doors ahead of the first public hearings on Wednesday. But Wall Street Journal Executive Washington Editor Jerry Seib says a lot is still up in the air.
We don't know whether the witnesses Republicans have asked to call, including Vice President Biden's son Hunter Biden, will ever appear or not. Republicans want to hear from Hunter Biden because they want to make sure one of the issues discussed publicly at this hearings is the work that Hunter Biden did for a Ukrainian energy company, which they say was a conflict of interest for Vice President Biden and one of the things President Trump legitimately wanted to know more about. And perhaps most important, we don't know yet whether John Bolton, the former Trump White House National Security Advisor, will testify publicly or not. He may be the most important, most knowledgeable person. He sat as a National Security Advisor at the intersection of the State Department and the White House. He saw all of the drama that is encapsulated in the Ukraine issue firsthand, but he hasn't spoken publicly about it yet. He's made it clear through his lawyers that he will testify only if a court says he must testify, because that would get around the White House insistence that he stay away. That may or may not have time to play out because Democrats want to move ahead quickly with this, perhaps take the whole investigation and hand it off to the Judiciary Committee so it can make a decision on articles of impeachment by mid-December.
That's Wall Street Journal Executive Washington Editor Jerry Seib. A former White House National Security Advisor who has asked a federal court whether he must testify in front of Congress is trying to keep Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney from joining his lawsuit. Charles Kupperman worked under then-National Security Advisor John Bolton. He says he's caught between a congressional demand to testify in the impeachment inquiry and a Justice Department that says he's immune because he served as a close presidential advisor. Mulvaney wanted to join that lawsuit, claiming the same holds true for him. But Kupperman's lawyers say it's different because Mulvaney is still a White House employee, and he may have waived his immunity when he told reporters there was a quid pro quo agreement between the U.S. and Ukraine. Former U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley is on a media blitz for her new book, and that has many speculating on her political plans. Haley is one of just a few former administration officials who has stayed on President Trump's good side despite criticizing him. We report that some officials in the White House are suspicious and argue she used her position as U.S. ambassador to promote herself instead of the president's agenda. Some say the former South Carolina governor is laying the groundwork for a run for the White House in 2024. U.S. banks have closed thousands of branches in the past few years and invested money in smartphone apps. But while half of people in the U.S. primarily go online to access their accounts, about a quarter of bank customers say they still like having a teller at a physical bank. So banks are struggling to strike a balance, and they're trying everything from relaxing the dress code for bank employees to more creative approaches for using the space. Joining me now with more details is Wall Street Journal reporter Allison Prang. So, Allison, you found that local branches of banks are in some ways having the same problems we're seeing with a lot of brick and mortars, and that is drawing customers in. What are the particular challenges for banks?
Yeah, with banks, and this is very similar to retail, is people have the ease of doing everything on their phone. You know, I can deposit a check on my phone. I can transfer money to my friends on my phone. I can pay bills on my phone. It's just, we live in a way more paperless society where I don't need to go in to a physical office of some kind and transact with someone to get something as, you know, elementary, you could argue, as paying a bill or moving money around done. And so banks are also facing the issue of, we have these locations similar to how, you know, stores have a ton of locations. You know, what do we do with these? How do we make them useful to people? How do we make people want to come there? And they're also kind of also advertising tools for banks, having a branch out there with their name on it. So they're in this tough spot like other industries are.
At the same time, and put this in context for us, we've been reporting that for the past few years, thousands of bank branches have closed. Are fewer people using them?
It's a lot more common, according to this FDIC survey I cited for 2017, that people want to use, for example, a website, online services, or a mobile app for their banking services. People still reported using a bank teller as their primary service, but it was a lot smaller of a chunk of people. So it's banks are stuck in this middle of having a balance. You're catering to both sets of customers. You're catering to more than two, a wide swath of generations, and figuring out where that sweet spot is and how to do both.
All right, that sounds like a tricky balance. So tell us about some of the things banks are trying.
Definitely. So Capital One, and this is not new, but we looked at it. They have these cafes, and they have Pete's Coffee is served in some of the cafes. If you have a Capital One card, it's half off to get the coffee. And then there's happy hours where it's free.
Happy hours at banks.
Yes, exactly. You know, it's not like they're serving an IPA, you know, but it's exactly. It's an idea of kind of come sit, hang out with us. Capital One, and this is in their branches too, their people kind of have more relaxed attire. There's let's open your account and an iPad. It's just kind of more of this chill. I feel like you could almost call it, just from thinking about what the traits are, a startup-y vibe a little bit. As opposed to this, you know, we have other traditional branches that I saw one at PNC, for example. That's more of what you would picture a bank branch, you know, pretty formal. Tellers behind glass. It's just more of a kind of business-esque vibe.
And I found this really interesting because Capital One surveyed their customers, and you write about this in your piece, and many of them reported that bank branches felt to them intimidating and stressful.
Exactly, exactly. So this idea of having it, let's, you know, chill down the bank branch a little and have it be more laid back, that really kind of speaks to how can we better cater to, you know, customers on the net. And if they're feeling a bank is a little bit too uptight for them. And money's a stressful thing for people, you know. I can see where the approach of how do we handle that is tough.
So what did you find about whether any of these methods are working?
That's a really good question. Capital One wouldn't really say how its cafes were doing totally. I think it's going to be really a matter of kind of like retail, where they're going to have to struggle to do, banks will have to struggle to do both things. You know, also make sure your digital offerings are up to snuff and you're keeping those customers and bringing people in. But that when I'm a customer and I do need help in person, you know, I'm able to go to your bank branch. So, you know, what customers ultimately tend to do and what banks they flock to, time will tell.
Wall Street Journal reporter Allison Prang joining me here in our studio in New York. Thank you so much, Allison.
Thanks so much.
From stretch marks to overindulging your sweet tooth to dirty laundry, real and metaphorical, there's a trend among celebrities and influencers toward being more authentic on social media. But sharing emotional baggage and struggles online can be risky, especially for teenagers. Joining me now with more details is our Wall Street Journal family and tech columnist, Julie Jargon. Julie, in many ways, we're used to seeing the best versions of people online because they can curate and present what they want people to see. But lately, you found more influencers and now teens are embracing more authentic representations online by sharing emotional struggles, especially around mental illness. And that can be a positive thing.
Yes, there's actually been research that shows that self-disclosure can be beneficial to people struggling with mental health issues, because by talking about it, sharing experiences, it can erase some of the stigma that had been associated with mental illness in the past, and it becomes, you know, more normalized and can really help people, you know, find a community of supporters and just be open about their struggles.
At the same time, we know that oversharing, whether it's in person or online, can make you more vulnerable. You also talk about something called sad fishing that happens online. Can you explain what that is and some of the other dangers here?
Yeah, so sad fishing was a phrase that was coined to describe the act of celebrities and influencers who share something that appears to be an emotional struggle as a way to hook the audience and to get some sort of personal gain, which on social media comes in the form of followers or likes. And, you know, it's questionable in those instances whether the people sharing that information, whether it's, you know, really legitimate or if they're just doing it because they see an opportunity to gain some sympathy or gain followers online.
And the problem here, as you explore in your piece, is when teens try to emulate this behavior, they can be especially vulnerable in these situations.
Exactly. For your run-of-the-mill teenager who's not a social media influencer per se, but is just out there, you know, trying to communicate with their friends, being vulnerable, which can be helpful online, can also attract the wrong kind of attention. Because what I've heard from a lot of experts in this field of cyber safety, is that, you know, online predators go looking for young people in particular who have some sort of vulnerability, because it gives them an opportunity to move in and kind of be the hero, provide the support that they may feel they're not getting elsewhere. And it engenders trust, you know, and that gives them an opportunity to prey on young people. And, you know, ask them to eventually meet with them or to send them photos. And, you know, the behavior can escalate and become dangerous.
So, Julie, how can parents help their kids find the right outlets and figure out what's best to share online and what's best to share with their loved ones or professional? What did you hear from the experts?
Yeah, it's definitely tricky. And the first step is to really figure out who your audience is and where you want to share this information. So if you're doing it on social media, for instance, you know, the simple first step is to privatize your social media account. Obviously, if you're looking to gain followers and become an influencer, that's not really going to work, but you could create your own private social media account that's separate, where you only have a close circle of friends that you trust who are part of that little, you know, social media community. And so you have to really know who you're communicating with and not just respond to direct messages from strangers. You know, check them out, see if they really are real, legitimate people of your age and not, you know, an adult who's posing as a teenager, for example. Another thing that I thought was really interesting and striking that a therapist suggested was state your intention. If you're a teenager and you're posting in your own account or in an online support group that you've found, be really specific in stating your intention for sharing whatever you're sharing. And you could say something like, you know, I'm just looking for some words of encouragement here. Because what that apparently does is it helps kind of solidify your, you know, what you're looking for. It can ward off potential predators because they see that you are being assertive and that you're, you know, you're not looking for someone to step in and be your best friend. You're just looking for some uplifting words. And it can also stave off bullies, you know, the trolls that are, well, you know, accusing the teenager of sad fishing. Can, you know, maybe not feel so encouraged to do that when they see, oh, this person's just a saying, I just, you know, had a bad day, I'm looking for some words of encouragement. One other thing that this therapist said is, you know, lead with a question and allow your teenager to feel like they're the expert. So rather than going to them and saying, don't do this, you can kind of open up the discussion by saying, hey, you know, I read an article about such and such. What's that all about? And let your teenager tell you something, and so that they kind of feel like they're the expert and they're informing you and that you're not just mom or dad coming and giving them a lecture.
That's our family and tech columnist Julie Jargon. To read her column, please head to our website, WSJ.com, or the WSJ app. And that's what's news for this Tuesday morning. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli for the Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.